What did the buffalo say to his son as he went off to college? Hi, son. Oh, come on, that's pretty
Why
good.
do wave functions make bad presidents?
Why do wave functions make a bad president?
Collapsing.
Their states always collapse.
Their states always collapse. Bravo. All right. That is great. Okay. All right, good morning. As I said before, I'm reusing some this lesson from yesterday. So I know we've sort of covered some related stuff. I think it'll still work and make sense. Here we go. Today is about Markov chain Monte Carlo, this really important algorithm, especially in data analysis. Before we start, I realized along the way that I made a mistake in talking about the jackknife. So maybe this makes you're like saying, oh, like it makes sense, like maybe about something you saw in the homework or something. Anyway, so I said, you run this jackknife procedure and you get a bunch of, leaving one data point out each time and you get a bunch of best fit values. And then you can just take those and they give you an uncertainty on the fit results. That's not correct. The mean is correct, but the variance is wrong. There's this extra factor of n in the variance. So if we were just using that the variance or like standard deviation method from the statistics package, right, which would compute that with one here instead of n. So the variances are entirely too small. So they should be this extra factor of the variances should be a factor of n larger. So the standard deviation should be a factor of square root of n larger. Yeah. So sorry about that. like, oh. So I have to go back and look at the homework and see how that affects the results. Because I know there was at least one question that sort of involved that. But anyway, coming back to today's topic of Markov chain Monte Carlo. Oh yeah, I have to, as I was preparing these slides, I found that my colleague Dan Forman-Mackie from Flatiron Institute made this like beautiful set of slides. So I blatantly have stolen and interwoven most of his slides this talk. So and you can see that he's got like a lot more like flair in his graphic design than I do. I'm very like plain, and Dan has a lot of flair in his slides. So you'll be able to tell which is which. Okay, so Markov chain Monte Carlo, at least in my world, comes up all the time when we're trying to do data analysis, especially when trying to do this generative style of data analysis. This is also called forward modeling. And the idea is that basically you want to write down like a numerical like function basically that goes from whatever physical process you're trying to model and tries to make predictions in the space of your data. We did this with the fitting a straight line thing, right? The model we were fitting there was a straight line, and we were making that make predictions in our data space. So our model had two parameters, right? The m and b, the like slope and intercept. And then with those model parameters, we could make predictions for what the y values should be. And then we were, and that was our in our that was the space we were measuring our data in. We were measuring data values or y values. So yeah, and basically in this generative view, you make that your model generate predictions of what your data would look like. So you can kind of contrast that to like estimator-based things where you would like take your data values and say sum them up or do kind of arithmetic on your data values and then use those to predict what the model values would be. And the reason to do it this way instead is that it's often really hard to come up with an estimator, especially as your phys as this data generation model gets more complicated. So basically, like when you take this view, that you then are doing inference to try to understand how your data constrain your model. And it's nice because this is placed in a statistical context. So there's like you're basically, sorry, this this part is going to be written as like basically probability distributions or statements about how likely things are, which means that it's pretty like mathematically well-founded. Okay, so I know that's pretty vague and sweeping. So I'm going to kind of switch a little bit into more statistical notation. So we saw I've kind of like now forgotten in the course of preparing for the symmetry school, I've forgotten exactly what we've talked about in our line fitting stuff so far. So apologize if I'm like getting confused about what you know or what you've covered already. But hopefully the recap will be useful, even if you've sort of seen this all before. But basically, another way of saying those two things was this is in the statistical notation, this is sort of how what this generative modeling looks like. So we're trying to write down a probability for drawing our particular data set if the physical model had a certain set of parameters. So here it's just writing physics, but really, like you're assuming a specific physical model, like a specific functional form that's going to have a set of parameters. And this is just all about constraining the parameters of those mo of that model. I'm going to go into a, like a concrete example in a second, so hopefully that makes more sense. I should say also that this notation is really terrible. So there are like four Ps here, and those are all different functions. Like they're all different functional forms, and the notation is just like basically anything that's a probability distribution gets called a P. And which one it is, like which function it is, depends on what the like arguments of the function are. So it's like a terrible notation. They really should be called, you know, P1, P2, P3, P4 or something. But like this is just what the notation is, and it's terrible. And these all have different names. So this one's called the likelihood because it's data given physics. And then, so basically, this inference process, what you really want to know about is to be able to put constraints on physics given the data you observed. Right? You'd like to, you don't fundamentally care how likely your data set was. You want to know what can I say about the world or what can I say about the universe given the data I observed. And in this statistical kind of notation, that comes out as a probability distribution. You know, you can say, oh, it's very likely that the slope of this line is whatever. And so that gets expressed as like a probability distribution over physics. And so to do that computation, you have, like, you know, we can, this is what we can write down pretty easily. And this is what we actually wanted to know. And this is done usually by doing Markov chain Monte Carlo. And so this is like an application of Bayes' rule or Bayes' theorem. And so, you know, kind of to get to the thing we want to do, we have to do like apply Bayes' theorem, which means we have to plug in this. Another weird looking thing, which is probability of physics, and then this likelihood. So this term is called the prior and is the cause of much hand-wringing and strife because it's basically you have to write down before you've seen any data or anything how likely you think parameters of your model are. So that makes some people very unhappy because it feels subjective. But it basically just is a requirement to make this work and like for the units to come out right. Okay, so let me go for an example, and hopefully that will make sense. Okay, so for an example, I took this Perlmutter et al. 1999 paper. And so what they did is they're cosmologists. They monitored the sky for many years and waited and looked for supernova explosions, so exploding stars. And then every time they detected a supernova, it would go off and monitor its brightness over the course of like the 10 days or so that it takes to brighten and then fade again. And it turns out that there's a few different kinds of supernovae. But one kind, these kind called type 1As, are thought to be a particular like arrangement of stars. I forget exactly what the details are. I really ought to look it up again. But and they're thought to be basically intrinsically all the same brightness. So kind of the way these explosions happen, the ingredients are the same for all of them. So then it's basically thought that they're all the same brightness intrinsically. Which is cool because you get to observe kind of the same process happening at different places in the universe, and in particular at different times. So by observing the peak brightness of this sample of supernovae, they can get a handle on how things, how distances and brightnesses relate in the universe. So distances in cosmology are a real pain because like the space is growing over time. So there's like four or five different kinds of distance that you can talk about. And distances are confusing. But one thing that is easy to measure is redshift. And that's much more easy to relate to kind of cosmic time. So what they did for this sample of supernovae was was measured the observed brightness of all of these supernovae, like peak brightness, and then measured the redshift of the galaxy that the supernova came from. So a supernova is a single star, you can measure the redshift of its galaxy. And you can think of this as basically like distance, like redshift is a proxy for distance. And then the brightnesses are measured in these astronomer magnitude units, so bigger is fainter. So this is kind of telling you how zero is today. So this is telling you how they get fainter as they move back in distance, more or less, right? And how that happens, and that kind of distance is called luminosity distance. It's kind of how things get fainter with respect to redshift. And exactly how that happens, like the shape of that curve, depends on what ingredients are in the universe. Because depending on what's in the universe, that depends on how the space-time grows, and then that affects how things get faint with respect to redshift. Okay, so there... So then their generative model basically is like the observed brightness is some intrinsic brightness plus this luminosity distance that depends on the redshift and then some parameters of their cosmological model. I'm gonna make that a little more specific. Okay, any questions on like on that part of it, on the like astrophysics or cosmology part of it? Okay, so saying again, so one thing, they're assuming a few things here. One of them is that they can measure the redshift. They're not putting any error bars in the redshifts. And that's because it's pretty easy to measure a redshift and to enough accuracy that it's much more accurate than the difference in brightnesses, like than the uncertainty in brightnesses. It's oddly harder to measure brightnesses than redshifts. So they're not assuming any errors on the redshifts. They're just treating those as like known values. They're assuming that all of these brightnesses, that they have their measurement and they have a known uncertainty, or like estimated uncertainty. And they're assuming those are Gaussian distributed. So they're assuming they have Gaussian errors on each of the data points. And they're also assuming that all of the data points are independent from each other. So that there's no reason that they would all be high or low, or that ones, say, measured on the same night are both high. So they're assuming they have statistical independence. And that comes up, that makes life much easier. Okay, so their generative model then is that for a single supernova, the magnitude they'll measure is this intrinsic magnitude that's shared amongst all of the supernovae. And then this luminosity distance that depends on the redshift of that individual one plus cosmological parameters. And then this error. And they're assuming this error is drawn from a Gaussian probability distribution with known variance. Make sense? Okay, so then, so once you've assumed that, you can write that as a probability distribution. You can say the probability of drawing a particular magnitude, of like observing a particular magnitude, is a Gaussian distribution of where, and the notation is like a Gaussian of like the value you observed given its mean and variance. And so the mean then is this model prediction, like this intrinsic mag plus luminosity distance. So in this fitting a straight line stuff, we were doing a very similar thing, except this function was just the y equals y predicted equals mx plus b. Yeah? So that connection is there. Here, it's a different function, but you know, basically the whole setup of the problem is the same. And then for the whole data set, if you assume that they're statistically independent, then the whole set of them, you can just take the product of all of the individual ones. And another way of writing this Gaussian is with this like n for normal distribution.
Can you assume the error in measuring the magnitudes is drawn from a Gaussian?
Why a Gaussian? Sometimes there's a physical reason. Sometimes it's kind of the easiest thing to assume. Central limit theorem tends to push you toward Gaussians. For magnitudes, it's a little bit weird because the magnitudes are a logarithmic unit. So but for small numbers, for small errors, it doesn't really matter that much. Partly it's because the math is easier. It's often accurate, it's often correct. So in astronomy, you usually get that if you measure in linear brightness units, that those are usually Gaussian distributed. And then if you take, when you switch into mag units where they're in logarithmic, then it's not quite a Gaussian anymore, but it's pretty close. So there's a little bit of hand waving going on. Sure, it's approximate, and it would throw off the inference a little bit. In fact, if you put in the wrong, you know, if you assume it's a Gaussian and it's actually not, then like if it's skewed or has a different shape or whatever, then it slightly changes your result. Okay, so yeah, basically this whole process is what I would call generative modeling. And so what you get at the end is this, you know, this equation is a likelihood function. And this is pretty, like, you know, you can turn, you could turn this into code from what you've seen. You know, you could, you've seen the functional form for a Gaussian. I can give you this luminosity distance function. And then, you know, basically you've computed this in your fitting a straight line examples. You know, that's a function that you can implement. And then once you plug it into a Markov chain Monte Carlo method, it can give you constraints on these model parameters. Ah, I forgot to say what the model parameters are. There are these cosmological parameters called omega m and omega lambda, which are like how much mass and how much dark energy are in the universe. kind of useful things to know. So, you know, basically by plugging what we'll see today, you know, you can plug this probability function into Markov chain Monte Carlo, and it can give you constraints on omega m, omega lambda. So, oh, right, I forgot. Okay, sorry, I forgot there's there's one more slide in this sequence. Yeah, so basically just that. They, by applying Bayes' theorem, they can come up with a probability distribution or a constraint over omega m, omega lambda, given their measurements, that is going to be just a prior over for those parameters times that likelihood we saw on the last page. Yo.
Isn't the dark matter density and dark energy density, aren't those functions of your redshift? So they're not quite.
Yeah, good. They are, the omegas are, I think they're like, they're defined at some point in time, and I don't know when exactly that is. They're like, it's some, I should know this, but I really don't. In general, yeah, they're like what the ingredients are at some point in time. Because the messy thing is that, for dark energy at least, when you, dark energy pushes space apart, and then when you make more space, there's more dark energy in the space you just made, right? So it, so you have to record like what it is at a certain point in time.
So are they functions of Hubble parameter?
Yes.
Yes. Thank you.
If you assume cosmological model.
So are they treated as constants or not?
They're, yeah, like for a given, yes. Yeah, like they're not changing as a function of redshift or anything in this case. So, okay, let me, okay, there's a plot I should draw. Yeah, okay, this is a good time to do it. So, if you think about an omega m, omega lambda space, and you think about any, you know, say you choose some point in this space, that's going to give you some prediction for this, for what the shape of this curve is. Right? Does that make sense? Like if you have, it probably doesn't go down again, but you know, if you have a single omega m, omega lambda prediction or parameter setting, that predicts one shape of curve. And if you move to, say, a different point in that parameter space, that's going to make a different prediction. Maybe it's lower at low redshift and higher at high redshift. That's supposed to be a different color. It doesn't really show up. And then we have a bunch of data points. I'll just draw like, you know, four of them or something. For each of these curves, it's making a prediction of what value you would measure at that redshift, right? So this curve's prediction of what you would measure is that. And you can see where that lies. This data point plus error bars is really just a shorthand for saying, I think the distribution of this is peaked here and sort of drops off as a Gaussian. Right? So you can see that this prediction hits that curve like there, you know. This is like a probability distribution turned on its side, you know. And similarly, that it's making a prediction here for this data point, and so on. And then this curve, so a different set of parameter values, is making a different set of predictions for each of these data points. This one says, oh no, you should have measured it. You should have measured a value way lower. And the experimenter would say, no, I don't, it really can't be that value. That value is really inconsistent with what I measured. You know, similarly, it's making a prediction here, prediction there, prediction there. So you can see that, you know, for this example, these two are both pretty low, and that one's okay-ish, and then that one's pretty high. You're like, that doesn't seem like a very good model. So then you would think, you know, this is probably not a very good place in this parameter space. Yeah?
If the error bars aren't drawn from the Gaussian distribution, or if it's skewed or extended, and it significantly changes your result, like, what like inferences are then drawn from that and not reliable?
Yeah, sure. So if instead of a Gaussian, this was some other shape, like say it was, I mean, you would still have the mean the same, so you would maybe change the skew. So maybe it's like, I'm going to fail to draw it correctly or something. But like, so one thing that can definitely happen is if you misestimate the width of that distribution, then you can, you know, if you made this error bar twice as big, then you would say, oh yeah, that's not a bad prediction. Maybe this value is okay after all. If you have the wrong shape, then it would just kind of move around a little bit which ones you're happiest with. So yeah, it definitely like steers around.
But then does that have, you know, big impact in like the sort of predictions you make, and is that
yeah, it could.
Built off of that, and is that bad?
It's all very unsettling, isn't it?
Yeah, very unsettling. What do people do about that?
A lot of checks that those predictions they're satisfied. So in this paper, they spend a lot of time basically on this question. If you have a lot of data points, they have 60 or 80 or something there. So what you can do is you can say, I thought that my error distribution was like this. And like, you know, kind of say if you rescale all of these to have the same, scale them in terms of their like individual means and variances. You can look at, so if you've got like a best fit curve, you can look at where it hits all of your data points and plot them up in this space and say, oh, you know, there were a bunch here and there was one out here and there was one down here, and you can build up that histogram. And then, so, you know, if your histogram is sort of like, then you're pretty happy. And if it's got like you know, a bunch of values out here and nothing in the middle or something, then you're pretty unhappy. So that's one kind of cross-check on like whether that distribution is accurate.
Okay.
Or you could do things like, instead of taking a single measurement, or to do a supernovae, but like if you, by basically repeating the measurement, like imagine that you, if you collect this measurement by say taking one observation every 2 nights for 2 weeks, then you could imagine repeating that experiment but shifted by a day and then splitting it in half and saying, like basically if I repeat the experiment, how do my values distribute? So yeah, basically cross checks and a bunch of
okay.
Consistency checks kind of is how people deal with these things mostly. Okay, so yeah, so basically Markov chain Monte Carlo is a way to do this thing we just did and said, oh, what if I try this place in parameter space? That's going to make a different prediction, a different predicted curve, and we're going to be more or less happy with that value, with how well it fits the data. And it's going to basically allow us to map out this space and say, yeah, these ones are out here, really not very good. Out here, not so good. Here, pretty good, pretty good, pretty good. Very good, very happy right here. You know, bad, 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 bad. And it'll help us, it'll allow us to numerically map out this space and say, oh yeah, like, and then you can draw a contour that sort of collects some fraction of those kind of good points that are consistent with the data. And that turns into like a constraint on what these values actually are. Because basically, you know, if you have a point, if you have some model parameters, it yields something that's totally inconsistent with your data. Like, you know, either your data are wrong or you've ruled out the model. Yeah.
So it is important where we start, right? The initial point.
Yeah, yeah.
Very offset, and then the subter is running, you know, I mean, even to left, down, wherever, it still is bad.
Uh-huh.
How can it understand which direction it should go to find that region in the parameter space?
Yeah, good, yeah. Yeah, so you can definitely have cases. I think this particular case is pretty simple in that I think it's as you move away from the good part of parameter space, things just get uniformly worse. So it's easy, like, so, you know, if you had a, so down here, if you have nothing in your universe, then it might be that that prediction is that they're all the same. It doesn't get fainter. And that's a pretty poor prediction because you're like, no, like it seriously got 15 magnitudes fainter. That's that's a million times fainter. So that's definitely ruled out. But usually you can start the sample, like you could start MCMC there. And as long as there's basically a gradient for it to follow, it's can say, oh, if I increase it a bit, if I put a bit of stuff in the universe, then things start to get fainter over time, and it can just follow that gradient and find the good place. Because it sort of doesn't uniformly rule it out as saying, oh, that's impossible. It has a numerical kind of score, like quality, or sort of like the objective function we were using, actually exactly like the objective function we were using for the optimizer. So what the optimizer we're using does is just finds its way to the peak and says, oh, that's the best one I can find. MCMC also explores not only the peak, but the area around it to say how constrained it is or like what other values near the peak are reasonable. We were using the jackknife to do that. But MCMC is kind of a like more numerically founded and statistically accurate way of doing that.
And as you explore this,
we're using both the probability of the magnitude given the parameters as well as the probability of the parameters as prior.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so the priors will come in. And I think should look up the I think in this particular case, I think they use what's called a flat prior or an informative prior. So I think they basically say that there's a uniform probability over some space of omega m omega lambda, like maybe between 0 and 1 maybe, or 0 and 2 or something. It kind of doesn't matter. Where you say, a priori, I have no preference for, I don't want to put any preference into the algorithm for having large or small values of omegas or whatever. Which like isn't actually what you believe, because you know, if you if there's nothing, we know that there's something in the universe, right? So you shouldn't really let the, you know, a priori, you don't believe that's a possibility. Pardon?
Both can't be
one. Yeah, you can put lots of stuff in the universe. That might make it make it closed or something. Like it can make, if you make them sum to one, then I think it's a flat universe and like triangles have 180 degrees. And if you make it different than one, then like you have a weird geometry. Yeah, there's omega k. To be honest, I'm pretty shaky on the cosmology at that level.
No, you're right. Because the definition of omega is the energy density of its component divided by the critical energy.
Okay, yeah, good. Okay. You should come teach this. So coming back to this, you know, once they've laid this out, they're going to run MCMC, which is going to let them kind of poke around in this parameter space and see which values of omega and of omegas are consistent with their data. And what they get is this result. So they're, after they run MCMC, they're going to draw a bunch of samples and then fit contours to it. And their contours are these blue ellipses. So those ellipses are saying that these sets of omega m's and omega lambdas are consistent with the data. And you know, in this cosmological model, depending on what you put in, different things happen in the universe. You know, I guess up there, no Big Bang. There's like, depending on what you put in, the universe can expand or collapse again, Big Crunch. You know, flat universe is where those two sum to one. One of the things this result lets them say is that if you believe the universe is flat, then their data constrain it to the ingredients to live basically in this corner. So in other words, you can't have a flat universe with no dark energy in it. Or in other words, if you think the universe is flat, then the dark energy has to be like about 3/4 plus or minus 10%. So by measuring these supernovae, they're able to say dark energy exists. So that was pretty big. They won the Nobel Prize for that.
So, okay, good question. So here, okay, so this plot shows it's possible that our universe is, no, does the flat line mean negatively curved?
I thought above the flat line meant that it's
close,
that it's like, yeah,
so
and it is like a geometry on a sphere, sort of distances.
So that's, so below the flat line is negative?
And then below the flat line is like,
does that mean
you want ADS CFT to be real.
Wait, what percentage are we talking about here? Because I'm not understanding. Is it, does it like the blue circle what we predict? And so there's like some chunk of it. It looks like to me like less than 20% that it's like DS or no ADS.
But
but it's still possible.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you take this at face value, then there's some probability that's like, it's not ruled out that there's that we're in a, that it's an open universe with like, you know, 40% dark energy and no mass. Like, which, you know, I disagree.
Wait.
Compared large, composed largely of baryons, I tend to disagree.
Mass if it is ADS, because like I think that
gets
much closer to the zero M part.
Oh, it's just like low matter density as a composed as compared to the critical density, like the,
yeah,
the matter density is less than the critical density. But is it, what is, do you know the matter density of the universe?
There's a constraint at this 0.3 at least, I think.
Oh.
So, 0.3, it's, I think, outside the ADS world.
No, it's pretty close. Teeny tiny, okay, maybe that's not enough. All right.
But what we know about the universe doesn't come just from supernova observation.
Yeah.
There's also that, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
One single observation, I don't really jump on
that. Yeah, you know. You know, you can.
Dustin, Would you mind to go back to the previous slide, please?
Sure. Yep.
It was omega int. What is that? In I'm sorry, magnitude int.
Oh yeah, sorry. Mag int was this intrinsic magnitude. Like I said, they're all the same brightness, and they're all like intrinsically the same brightness. And then we see them as fainter because they're at different distances. That's kind of one way of laying it out is for that to be another parameter in the model. So in addition to measuring, to estimating omega and omega lambda, you can say, oh, there's another parameter I need to figure out, which is this intrinsic magnitude. And in this case, that just shifts the curve, the whole curve up and down. So instead of finding a place in this 2D space, you'd have to find a 3D kind of ellipsoid that would be consistent with the data. And then you kind of don't care about that. That intrinsic magnitude doesn't win you a Nobel Prize, so you ignore it. It's like a nuisance parameter. It's something you have to reason about, but you don't actually fundamentally care about. Okay, how are we for time? We're at 10:30, perfect. 10 o'clock, perfect. Okay, so hopefully that motivates why you want MCMC, because you want to win a Nobel Prize. Other prizes are available and much better, but so MCMC basically, you know, is a way of solving these real life statistical models. In this case, the constraints were actually kind of, you know, ellipsoidal looking, but often they're not, and often they don't really have a known like analytical or functional form. So you know, it's easy to write, or relatively easy to write down the generative model, but the form that the, that has on the constraints isn't often easy to write down. So a way to represent them is with samplings. So it's a probability distribution, and MCMC lets you draw samples from that probability distribution. So MCMC basically is this tool that can let you draw samples from a probability distribution where you have to be able to compute it numerically, but you can't solve it analytically. So that's what it's for, what it does for us. So I just have a couple of like examples of that from the literature. I'm not gonna talk about what the axes are or what's being figured out here, but basically, like, you know, you can see this distribution. This is a set of samples drawn from a distribution. And although that looks pretty Gaussian, this is definitely not Gaussian. This is a value that's forced to be positive. So we'd be kind of hard pressed to write down like what the actual functional form of that is. Another example is this really odd looking one, where these are the contours. You know, it has some like some weird blobby probability distribution. This is looking at something about the non-Gaussianity of fluctuations in the early universe. Okay, so Dan's way of writing that is this. You know, MCMC draws samples from a probability distribution, and all you need to be able to do is evaluate the function. So I'm going to give you like a sketch of how the MCMC algorithm works. And then I'll give you the code for it. And then in the tutorial session this afternoon, you'll implement it yourself and mess around with it. Experiment. What's being plotted here is a parameter space, like say our omega m, omega lambda, and the so those are the axes, and then these are supposed to be contours of that probability function. So, you know, again, remember for each point in here, each point in this space corresponds to a curve that makes predictions of what each of our data points would have been. And then we can compute what the likelihood of our data point was given all of those predictions. And if you multiply those all together, that gives you the likelihood for the whole data set. So what this is the contours of that probability, of that like likelihood for that whole set of data observations. Does that make sense? So it's a little bit like there's like three steps going from a point in this space to the probability. It's making a model prediction and then measuring the likelihood of your data points in that given that prediction. So we often talk about this as being like a terrain I often think of it as a terrain. Like, so I think of these as like the contour lines on a map. So like this probability space is like a long mountain with a thin mountain with a ridgeline. And we want to map out its contours. We'd like to know not only where the peak is, but like the shape of the mountain.
Well, can you say one more time, maybe as an example, maybe with this one, what would be the axes?
Yeah, right. So the axes would be like whatever model parameters we have.
What's the difference between that and like doing this with the critical densities?
You can imagine that the axes here are omega m, omega lambda for this example. Yeah, it's the same thing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so these like that contour is these contours.
Okay.
And yeah, I often, yeah, I often think of it as being like a physical landscape walking around in. So Markov chain Monte Carlo is going to like basically simulate moving a particle or walker or sample around this landscape. And you want it to find the peak of the, find the mountain in the probability space, and then kind of walk around it, spending most of its time on the peak, but also spending some time on the sides of the mountain. So, okay, so what it does is you start at some point in the parameter space. It kind of doesn't, in this case, it doesn't really matter where you start because it's, there's sort of like a gradual slope up to the mountain. And then at each point, it's going to take many, many steps. And at each step, you propose to jump from where you are to some new place. And that's usually done, that's just done randomly, usually with a Gaussian step. you draw some Gaussian random number and move in that direction, or two Gaussian random numbers in this case, and move in that direction, or adjust your parameters by that amount. So that's proposing to jump to a new position. And then you evaluate the probability at that place. I stole these slides, and if I were redoing them, I would omit this part for now. So what we're going to do when we hit this new point, we're going to evaluate where it is in this terrain, like its height in this terrain. And that is, we're going to measure the probability, or the probability at that new set of parameters. And we're going to compare it to the probability at the where we were. So, you know, you had the, you can compute the probability or the height in that terrain of where you were, and then you jump to a new place and you say, is it higher or lower?
So this is the probability to be smooth, right?
Pardon?
If the P local like peaks.
Yeah, so if it has local maxima, then you can get trapped in a local minimum or a local maximum, I guess. You can make your way to the top of a little hill, and then there's a mountain over there, and you can not know about it. There are some ways. I'll come back to that in a bit. But yes, it's a in theory it's not a problem, but in practice it is. That's how life is with the MCMC. It's theoretically beautiful and practically kind of a pain sometimes. So basically this decision about whether, so you know, you propose a jump, measure whether it's higher or lower than just where you were. If it's higher, you always accept, and if it's lower, you accept randomly in proportion to how much lower it is. So if the probability is a quarter as large, then you accept the jump a quarter of the time. So it's like if you propose a step that goes uphill, you always take it. And if you propose a step that goes downhill, you sometimes take it. And if it goes far downhill, you rarely take it. If it's a little bit downhill, you often take it. Does that make sense? And one nice thing is that it only cares about the relative probabilities. And then this process repeats. You draw another, you propose stepping in another direction. One problem with this example is that you have to imagine the contours keep going here. And then, you know, so the contours, if you step from here to here, you're actually stepping up like many contours of that probability distribution. So that step would definitely be accepted. Whereas this one is, you know, moving away from that distribution, so that's quite a bad step. So that one probably gets rejected. So you reject that step. And then there's a little quirk in the algorithm. It seems weird, but when you reject a step, you still record the position. So you propose to move to another place, decide not to, but then you also you still record the fact that you decided to stay there, basically. And that's important because at the end, you know, as you spend a lot of time doing this, you end up moving, like walking around this parameter space. And this whole set of places you visited on that walk is, in the limit of infinite time, is a fair sampling from that distribution. So that's the magic of Markov chain Monte Carlo of this algorithm, is that as you run this process for a long time, the set of places you visit, according to these rules, is a fair sampling from that distribution.
Why does recording staying somewhere make it more confusing?
I don't know if my intuitive explanation for it is that it's kind of like if you're in a point in the distribution and you're offered the opportunity to jump to different places that are worse, then that's an indication that where you are is good. No, I don't know if that is an appealing way of thinking about it.
Because you're more likely to stay at the place that has the higher likelihood.
Yeah, exactly.
So
like,
it gives more weight to the places.
Yeah, that's right. So it gives more weight to like places that are good enough that it's hard to propose moving somewhere better. Okay, so mathematically, what the thing it has to satisfy is that it has to preserve what's called detailed balance, which is connected to like ideas from thermodynamics. But it's essentially that your probability of being at a point and jumping to another point is that is equal to the probability of being at other point and jumping between them, like the jumps between them have equal probability. Let's mess this up. But yeah, basically like in the limit, this distribution has to be steady state. Yes. Okay, yeah.
When you chose a point randomly and then you want to jump to another point, you said you choose a Gaussian distribution.
Yeah, you can do other things, but yeah, Gaussian is a pretty common, simple way of thing to do.
Why is Gaussian preferred over any other distribution? Because it's mathematically easy? Or?
It's easy, yep. Yeah, pretty much because it's easy. You can do other things. You can experiment with other things in the lab this afternoon. That's kind of the algorithm. That's how it is, or like that's a sketch of the algorithm at least. Yep.
Quick question. Could you go back to slides?
Yep, for sure. There. One more.
So.
Oh yeah, okay. Yeah. So ignore the cues.
So there is a probability that the next step is not going to be accepted or it's being accepted. And that depends on those.
Yeah, on the relative probabilities.
Can we change that one?
If you change the one, then you don't preserve detailed balance. It's very easy to mess up the detailed balance. And then if you do that, then you just end up sampling the wrong distribution. There are many things where you're like, couldn't we do it differently in this way to make it smarter? And usually the answer is like, if you do that, you mess up detailed balance. So this is like another part of the, like, you know, the power and the frustration of working with this algorithm is that it's like, it works great as long as you don't change like anything. So it's kind of delicate. Okay, so the name, it's a like a large intimidating name, right? But it's kind of funny because the Markov's chain Monte Carlo. So Monte Carlo is just a reference to a casino in Monaco. And it basically just evokes the fact that there's randomness in this algorithm. You're rolling dice about whether you are going to, where to jump and whether to accept the move or not. So that's just saying it's got randomness in it, like a casino, in particular this swanky casino. Yep.
Is it always okay to choose the Gaussian distribution for the next step and a symmetric one of that?
Yeah, good. Yes. So, you need the Qs if you have a distribution that's not symmetric for your proposal. The only reason I'm hesitating to say, like, basically, I think the answer is yes. It's basically always fine to do the Gaussian. The only thing I'm not sure about is whether, if you propose to jump to a part of the parameter space that has zero prior, and I'm not exactly sure what happens. I think it's fine, but I forget whether that messes up detailed balance. Yeah.
That's
maybe
a slightly vague question, and also I apologize if he's very correct.
It's okay, yeah.
But I agree with there's some kind of connection between CMC and statistical physics.
I also don't know. I'm sorry. Like, I know the people working on these things were, you know, they were definitely like thinking about ensembles and, you know, moving about. Yeah.
Okay, so I've got a question, because like traversing like this kind of probability distribution seems kind of like, you know, searching around on a lost landscape.
Uh-huh.
And so usually with a lost landscape, you have some learning rate that sets like how big of the jump you have, but
mm. uh-huh.
set. So which one's better? And a step size that's like taken from a Gaussian distribution is better than, I don't know, is it used a lot? I mean, you would know.
They're different things.
Oh, really?
This comes from ergodic theorem.
What's ergodic?
If you have some samples that have some properties, you can find the mean. You have good estimators for some parameters, like the mean and standard deviation.
Okay.
You're getting the probability distribution, the distribution of the.
This is good. So another reason to want to be able to draw samples from a probability distribution is for estimating things. You know, if you have some, for taking integrals. So if you want to do some integral of some function of x times some probability of x, if that's a high dimensional space, then that's a real pain. But if you can draw, if this is a probability and you can draw samples from it, then you can turn that into, sorry, I've jammed myself into the corner of the board. I'm going to go this way instead. You can turn that into a sum over a bunch of samples out of that probability space. That function at a bunch of samples from that probability space, and then over. You know what I mean? So you know, if you can, so you can turn like high dimensional integrals into just sums over samples. So that's the other place where MCMC kind of is widely used. Now, the catch is that that sort of converges as like 1 over the square root of n. Like it converges pretty slowly.
What did you say the rate of convergence
was? I think it's like basically 1 over square root of n.
I don't know.
Just, you know, it's like proportional to that. Okay, yeah, so the name, the Monte Carlo part is just that it's got randomness in it, which, you know, when these algorithms were being developed in like the 50s, that was a pretty big deal. Like, you're gonna draw noise and use it in your algorithm? Why would you do that? You're gonna take, we went to, took us a lot of work to make these measurements, and you're gonna use noise in the machine? How do we even generate noise in the machine on purpose, you know? So it was a big, like, kind of a pretty big thing to think about. Okay, so, and then Markov chain. Here, a chain is just a list of samples. And the Markov property is that that each sample in the chain is drawn from using a process that depends only on the previous sample. So it doesn't know about the whole history, it just knows where it is now, and then there's a process for drawing the next sample. So that's all that the tag Markov means. So it's a Markov process, which just means that it only depends on the current state, not on the whole history of how you got there. Markov was a 19th century Russian mathematician, and like he's got the glorious mustache to go with it. And a Wikipedia page that is like a yard long of things named after him. So I don't know if he was like a really good mathematician or a really good like marketer, but either way, it's a thing to behold. And then a name I didn't say, but is in the corner of the demonstration was Metropolis Hastings, which is kind of this particular rule, like that particular set of proposal and acceptance rules. And it's like by far the most common flavor of MCMC. And those are the lead authors of some papers that basically they laid out the, you know, computer program to implement it. For the Metropolis one, at least, there's some argument about who should actually get the credit for that. It's not obvious that Metropolis is the one who should, but it's kind of pretty entrenched in the...
I was just looking him up, and he has a brother, yeah, they're both fantastic extensions.
Oh yeah, Andre and the other Markov?
Yeah, but this Markov is mustache is more elegant.
More elegant? Okay. All right. Oh yeah, right. Okay, so yeah, you know, it's a lot of words for a pretty simple algorithm. Okay, so here's a sketch of the algorithm. I'm going to add detail in a couple of steps. Sorry, I'm using Python notation here, so you'll have to translate to Julia for yourself, or rather, I'll maybe try to translate for you. So our Markov chain Monte Carlo routine is a function, and what we have to give it is this probability function that we're going to evaluate, right? We have to tell it, this is a function that says, if I'm at a place, what's the height in the landscape, in the probability landscape at that place? We have to give it a proposal function. So if I'm at a place, where shall I go next? Where shall I propose to go next? We have to give it an initial position in the space and how many steps we want to run for. And what we're going to do is record is keep track of our position and probability as we move around this space. So the position will just start out the initial, the probability we get by calling this probability function with where we start. And then we're going to build this chain, or just list of samples, or list of places we've been. And I'm going to do that just by looping for n steps, and then recording at the end of the process, or like after each step, where we are. And then at the end, we just return that whole set of places we were. So each time through the loop, we'll propose jumping to a new place, compute the probability at that new place, and then decide whether to jump there or not. Yeah? Makes sense. Okay, so I'm going to fill in those bits. So, so here's the propose. You know, you propose jumping to a new position by calling the propose function with where you are, and that gives you a p nu. Pass that p nu to the probability function to get the probability there, and then make this decision. So this decision is written in a kind of weird way. So what we do is draw a uniform random number. So that's a number between 0 and 1, right? If the probability in the new place is greater than where we were, if it's an uphill step, then this value is greater than 1. So it's always greater than whatever random number we would draw between 0 and 1. So we kind of didn't need to draw the random number in the first place. Yep.
Don't know what the probability distribution looks like, and we're doing this to find out what it looks like. How do we find the probability at the place?
You can. Basically, we don't know the contours until we've mapped it out. Yeah, exactly. So this often gets used in situations where the dimensionality is getting bigger, like for higher dimensional, where there are more parameters. So it would be impractical to map it out in just by evaluating it at a bunch of grid points.
So,
because, you know, it's fine, it's easy to map out a two-dimensional space with 100 points in each dimension or something. But if you have to do that on like 6 dimensions, then you're talking about an infeasibly large number of points.
I think also in the Bayes theorem, you said proportional, so the marginal likelihood in your denominator, calculating that is intractable. And so you can probably find px as proportional to something else, but you can't find the normalization factor or whatever. So that's finding that is intractable. So you propose something like this, in which you have a ratio of two probabilities, so that you get rid of that constant thing. So you can calculate the probability
basically, what you're doing, it's not that we don't have px, right? We have that round base. But the point is that we want to maximize or minimize the log of w, log of 90. But we were doing.
Right, yeah.
But if you have, as you said, more than two dimensions, I mean, five. Parameter space.
Yeah, exactly.
Minimize that function, right? And that's the point of MCMC. Is it
correct? Yep. Yeah, pretty much. Yep.
Every point in parameter space.
Sorry, say it again.
Sort of sweep every parameter, every value in the parameter space, and then make this contour or the.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so it's an alternative to like evaluating on a grid.
Yeah.
but in higher dimensions, a grid becomes very, very time consuming to deal with. Okay, yeah, so, right, so if the probability at the proposed place is greater than where we were, then that's a value greater than one, and we always accept it. If it's less, so say the probability nu is a quarter as big as the current probability, it's a step downhill, it's one quarter as big, then this value is a quarter, 0.25. And then if you draw a random number, if you draw a random number between 0 and 1, then a quarter of the time it'll be less than that one quarter, and three quarters of the time it'll be greater than, so a quarter of the time you'll accept the move. So that's how, like, that's how you can implement this check of, like, if you go downhill, then you accept it in proportion to how much downhill you went. Yeah?
Sorry, apologies, this was already asked. If we replace this uniform random between 0 and 1 with, like, a fixed number or another distribution, would we affect, like, the guarantees, like, the results?
Yep. Yep, exactly. Okay. Like, if you mess with it, you break detailed balance.
Gotcha. And does this have to do with, like, the Markov chain that you're constructing, or like if you're at a node and then you're like going this way with probability one, or like this way with some uniform distribution, like that is required to prove the results of like the Markov chain that you're in?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, like this is, yeah, exactly. This is like producing our Markov chain with the required properties. And then, yeah, basically, if you accept the move, you know, you update p to be p nu and prob to be prob nu. And then, you know, regardless of whether you accepted the move or not, you scored where you decided to. Okay, so two practicalities. One is that, as you saw, we usually like to work in log probabilities. Mostly because if you just work in straight probabilities, the probabilities can be small. And then when you multiply a bunch of them together, they can get so small that they get smaller than you can easily represent on the computer. And then it turns to zero. And then you have zero probability, and then you're sad. So switching to log probs, everything just turns into logs where you'd expect. Then this, when you do this comparison, instead of doing the division, you have to subtract them to do the division in log space. And then you have to take an X to get back into like linear space to do the comparison with the uniform random number. But other than that, it's basically just the same. It's just a, you know, numerical convenience to work in log space, or a numerical inconvenience maybe. The other practicality is you often want to, well, you'll definitely see in the lab, you often want to record how often you decided to accept the to accept the proposal. So you often record this like number of times you accepted the move, and then at the end you'll return this and accept. Because it helps you to, it'll help you to tune your proposal function.
It helps what?
You'll see you have to, in the lab, you'll have to tune this proposal function. So actually, I have a couple slides on that now. Okay, good. 7 minutes left. Perfect. There's there's an issue with the proposal function, which is that if you take, like, if your proposal function is like this, like if you're, you know, drawing samples from this distribution and proposing to go there, then if you're on this ridge line, a lot of your proposals are like, I'm on a mountain, let's jump off the mountain. And, you know, and the algorithm is going to say, no, I don't think we should do that. You know, so if you, and it's relatively rare then to say, oh, let's walk along the ridgeline. You know, there's a lot more area that's like, let's jump off the mountain than let's walk along the ridgeline. So if your proposal distribution is shaped like that, like proposing fairly large steps, then you'll spend a lot of time saying, no, I don't think we should do that. I don't think we should go there. I think we should stay where we are. And that leads to what's called the small acceptance fraction. So it's pretty rare to actually accept a proposed step. So you'd say, okay, let's make the proposal smaller. Let's propose smaller steps. And then, as you kind of expect, like it just takes you a really long time to get anywhere if you take tiny steps. You know, it's sort of like being, it's kind of timid. It's like, oh, let's try over here. Oh, that's slightly uphill. Let's go there. Let's try over here. It's a little bit downhill, but yeah, we're probably okay to go there. And you know, it just takes you forever to get anywhere. Especially since, you know, it has an element of it takes you closer to a random walk in some ways, right? If you take larger steps, then there's a bigger difference between good steps and bad steps. So it's sort of further from a random walk, whereas like tiny steps are like, it's getting closer to a random walk and it just takes you forever to get anywhere. So when that happens, you get a relatively large acceptance fraction, which seems good, but it just means that you're taking steps that are too small. So it turns out that you want the acceptance rate to be like a third or like less than a half. There's some theoretical statement that it's supposed to be like 0.23, which like just intuitively feels too low to me. But you know, it's what the statisticians claim. So yeah, people often shoot for an acceptance ratio of like a third, something like that, or 0.3.
Yeah, so in the quantum Monte Carlo world, there are some special algorithms that have global types of moves that are guaranteed to have a probability of one acceptance ratio. And those are sort of the ideal things, but they're only limited to a few models.
Interesting.
Like special families of parameters or tricks you can do to make things like that.
So I like no, I think.
Yeah,
like I think so if you like kind of the ideal case is if your probability distribution or your proposal distribution basically matches the shape of your actual probability distribution. Then, you know, the proposal is like, let's sample from the distribution. and then, you know, it accepts those samples with the correct proportion and, you know, life is happy. Yeah.
Is there an intrinsic reason why the
No, other than to make our lives difficult for ourselves. It does often come up. It's often difficult to come up with a parameterization that is sort of orthogonal or isotropic or whatever. But usually it's just to illustrate or emphasize the fact that it's an issue. We did see that our straight line fitting simple M and B parameterization had this property, or it was anti-correlated, but you know, it had this sort of shape for the parameters. That's actually one of the main issues with MCMC, that it is sensitive to the parameterization. On Thursday and Friday, I'm going to talk about a different algorithm that doesn't have this property, that is affine invariant. So it makes our lives easier. But yeah, it's it's true, you know, it's like an illustrative or like an example that's highlighting this difficulty.
Sorry, if I may make a comment.
Yeah.
If you have any kind of function and you look at the function near some extremum, near maximum, for example, and then you do a Taylor expansion there, then you're getting a constant term that we don't care about, and we're getting a quadratic term. And in higher dimensions, the quadratic term will not look spherically symmetric, but will look like any others. And in this kind of plot, of course, you want to plot what happens near the maximum. So generically, it looks like an ellipse, so if you include higher order terms, like a banana or something.
Mm-hmm.
Generic thing about how functions look like, and then we're looking here next to the model.
So, but what if these two parameters are independent? I mean, then we get a circuit, right?
Yeah.
No correlation.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, if they move you in kind of orthogonal directions, then yes, yeah, you can get.
I wanted to ask this. So, from contours, what we can infer is one is which region in parameter space we have higher likelihood, and the other thing is, what is the correlation between these parameters?
Yep, exactly. Yep.
Okay.
And it means that, it means that you can't, if you try to just write down your uncertainty on this parameter, then that's going to be relatively large, even though, if you write down like your uncertainties individually on the two parameters, it's going to look like you have really poor constraints, but you actually know that they're really tightly correlated. So your constraint on their joint distribution is much stronger than your constraint on their individual distributions. Or, you're confident about some combination of them. Okay, so in kind of an ideal world, you can figure out what this shape of this distribution is to propose to jump. But then the issue is that even in two dimensions, that's three parameters you have to come up with just for your proposal distribution. And then if you try to do like a five-dimensional problem, you have to figure out like 15 parameters. You know, so then your life just becomes difficult. As Dan says it, you want to do scientific awesomeness where you have a large number of parameters in your model. And your life should be that like your life doesn't get more difficult as you get more awesome. But what Metropolis Hastings gives you is like, as you try to be more awesome, life gets quadratically more difficult. So that aspect of it is displeasing. I know something's going right when people are taking pictures of slides. Love it. Sorry, I'm at time, so I'll wrap up. I'm going to skip that because that was trying to... going to skip all that. So basically, I'm telling you about MCMC because it really does come up all the time in probabilistic inference. Basically, if you read any kind of experimental paper and it's got some contours in parameter space, chances are really good that somebody ran an MCMC. It's one thing for me to tell you about it, and then you'll see it this afternoon in the lab, and you'll sort of see for yourself. It, you know, has this beguilingly simple algorithm, but the practicalities can be really painful. And it has this beautiful theoretical guarantees, but only as the compute time goes to infinity. You know, it guarantees that no matter where you start in the space, you'll find and explore the peak. If there are two peaks separated by a large prairie, you will spend the correct amount of time in each peak. In practice, it doesn't work that way, but in the limit of infinite time, it does. It's kind of because of these complexities that it remains like a thing that people think about rather than just like a solved problem that you just throw your model in there and solve it and it's done and you don't have to think about it. Okay, that's all.